Well, he's been on the program before. Alcohol can be a gas. Remember that one? Well, we're going to be talking with David Bloom in a moment about some alternatives, just so what has happened in the Gulf of Mexico doesn't happen again, though it could. David Bloom next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. David Bloom, Executive Director of the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture and the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. He is a leading advocate for alcohol fuel and the role of the American farmer has in developing this sustainable energy and food policy for the post-oil era. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Boy, David, I don't want you to say I told you so, but go ahead. Say it.
I told you so.
Yeah. What a mess. What a mess.
Well, you know, it's entirely predictable, and it's not unexpected, and here we are, you know, and it's all a symptom of, you know, basically looking at the way we've been pumping the easy-to-get-at oil, and there's not as much of that anymore. So these riskier kinds of operations are what we're reduced to now in this, you know, in this era. You know, the oil that we have been pumping was easy to get at, and, you know, even then we had quite a few major disasters, but, you know, the oil companies had assured us that that was in the past and technology had triumphed and we can drill to ridiculous depths now to in safety and in comfort. And, well, you know, as I said, this is not going to be the case. And oil is only one of the scary, nasty things that, you know, high pressure oil from under the ocean floor, one of the scary, nasty things that we're going to be looking to for fuel over the next few decades. And we have better ways to go.
Why do I have the feeling that BP is not even going to get a hand slap on this one?
Well, George, you know, this was arranged a long time ago because, as we all know, the Exxon Valdez cost, you know, the oil companies over $2 billion in cleanup costs over 4 years. And they, you know, really were reeling for over 20 years from the mass of lawsuits from everyone who lost their livelihood. All the people who, you know, did oyster farming, who did fishing, who did all of those things, those were very profitable businesses. And all of those folks sued Exxon, and they held those people off for more than 20 years, making profit on all the money they were not paying out to the people who had won their lawsuits. So the oil industry said, hey, you know, no one's looking. We're going to go ahead and make a deal. So they went to Congress, and Congress was saying, you know, we got to do something about this spill stuff, and, you know, we need to have some money in place to clean up some of these spills. So they passed the Oil Spill Liability Act, and they taxed the oil companies 8 cents a barrel to go ahead and have some money on hand in case there was, well, a blowout in the bottom of the Gulf. But 8 cents a barrel is almost nothing. It's only about $1.5 billion in the fund after all these years. But the oil companies never give in to something like this without getting something back. And what they got back was an exemption from liability above $75 million. So if you're a shrimper down there in Louisiana and you're going to sue them for the loss of your livelihood, get in line. But there won't be much when you get there because the oil companies are protected from all those damaged lawsuits. They still have to clean up the mess. But they have already engineered a legal way out.
Well, and that's the number that the head of BP continues to throw out. He says we'll spend $75 million, not anymore.
Well, and that's, you know, any more than that will require 20 years of lawsuits. But by then, you know, we won't be using any oil anymore as a fuel. And heck, you know, they'll be on to more profitable things, they hope. But expect that for all the talk that BP says, well, we're going to take care of everybody. We're going to clean up the mess. That's true. They're going to try to clean up the mess. And of course, the Exxon Valdez, they cleaned up maybe 5% of the oil.
Yeah.
But and they'll do that much. But they're not going to pay anyone for ruining their livelihood, for damaging their beaches. And the incredible, nasty health effects that everyone in the next weeks, in the weeks ahead, are going to be experiencing from the oil byproducts blowing ashore.
It's obvious marine-based drilling is not safe.
Well, you know, we've had lots and lots of accidents. It's not even new in the Gulf. I mean, our biggest accident in North America was not the Exxon Valdez. It was the Ixtoc, exploded rig over in shallow water, over to closer to Mexico, and that slick was over 20 times what this one was, and it took 9 months to cap. So, you know, is it safe? Boy, I'll tell you, there hasn't been a good track record on that so far. And the thing about it is, the deeper we go, the higher the pressure the oil is. So now we're talking thousands of pounds per square inch. In other words, all the water and all the rock, you know, create pressure on the deposits of oil in the sands and in the gravels that contain it. But that oil is under tremendous pressure under all those miles of rock. And so when you punch a hole into it, well, you know, it's basically not an oil leak. It's an oil geyser. And, it's going to be really scary to see them try to lower this big block of concrete on the end of a chain. Let's hope that this 20-foot wide thing doesn't swing a little and break off the head of the well. That's the thing I'm worried about.
Oh, yeah, then it's even worse. Do we even have the technology to fix these things?
Oh, no. No, because you got to figure the oil companies are only planning on another 20 to 30 years worth of extraction before they're out of the liquid oil business. And they're going to be into other alternatives that are safer and hopefully more profitable for them that they can extract on land. So this deep oil is kind of an interim technology until they get into the stuff that's, well, really filthy and will be replacing liquid petroleum. Because, well, according to the International Energy Agency, which you may or may not decide is credible, but they're now saying that oil production is going to drop 6-7% a year from now on. And you think, well, that's not so bad, 6%, you know, just a little bit. But in 10 years, that's the majority of oil production today. And our use of oil is going up. So 10 years is not a long time to come up with solutions. This is the temporary solution. Go drilling in places where the oil is hard to get at and high pressure until other technologies come online. And there's no guarantee. And we got to hope that these other technologies do not get developed.
Is Halliburton's name being bantered about it?
Yeah, we were calling them today a hella blowout. You know, they're quite a ball of wax. You know, the whole thing about wells, I mean, you know, even a water well that's in a touchy area, you have to pour cement around the pipe that goes into the ground to kind of basically seal the outside of the pipe against mm-hmm. the rock. If you don't, whatever you're drilling either can go up or down along the pipe, and let's say in the case of water, contaminate your water table by draining down.
Sure.
Or in the case of this high-pressure oil, it could blow around, you know, that pipe and come out. And no one is saying exactly what happened to this well, but one worker has come forward saying, hey, you know, Halliburton has blown it before when it comes to cementing these wells, and that was their job on this one. You know, we've had about 39 blowouts, I guess, over the last 10, 15 years, and 18 of them were for bad cement jobs around
seals,
around right? the pipe.
Yeah.
Well, you can't even see what you're doing down there at 5,000 feet. It's a mile underwater. So,
and how do you put concrete around something when you got the ocean floor down there?
Well, you have to use what's called hydraulic pumping. So they're trying to inject the cement down around this let's see, 22,000 feet. That's about a 4 mile pipe, and they're hopefully doing it in a way that packs the cement in the upper portion to prevent the leakage of natural gas. You got to realize, you know, oil, when it's down there in the sand and in the rocks, it's not just black goo. It's like black soda pop, because natural gas is all through it, and it's almost like carbonated soda under the best of conditions. And when you bring the oil to the surface, well, the natural gas comes also. And in fact, that's what pressurizes the well up on land to get oil out of the ground before you have to start pumping it. So, you know, all the pictures we've seen of, you know, they strike oil and there's a gusher of oil coming out of the rig. Well, that's being pushed up to the surface by the natural gas that has been created along with the oil. And once that pressure is gone, like in Saudi Arabia, Now, to get the oil out of the ground, we pump huge amounts of water into the well to pressurize the well with water, and then that pushes the oil to the surface because the energy to pump oil from a way down distance is, more costly than the oil is worth. So around the United States, we have thousands and thousands of oil rigs that are no longer pumping because they don't even put out 5 barrels a day of oil. And that's about what it takes for the energy to pump oil out of the ground. So, it's a natural progression of oil wells to start off with tons of pressure like this, and then, and then go ahead and become stripper wells where we have to pump the oil.
Mm-hmm. They're talking about gallons gushing out. How come they're not talking about it in terms of barrels?
Well, they have been talking about it in terms of barrels, because a barrel is 46 gallons. And so a barrel is a lot smaller number than the number of gallons. And so it looks better. Like, oh, it's only 5,000 barrels a day. And, you visualize a 55-gallon barrel, and it looks like, 5,000 barrels, it doesn't sound like so much. But that's not the real figure. You're not finding independent estimates, except for a couple of nonprofit agencies that operate looking over environmental problems and doing that estimating with experts. And Skywatch came over the site days ago and said, this is not 210,000 gallons, which is the current estimate that BP has, but it's really probably 1.1 million gallons a day. And that puts us already, you can already hear it from the government, that puts us at a level already above the 11 or so million gallons that were let out by the Exxon Valdez. So they can't get their numbers straight. They tell the press one thing, then another, but the reality is it's a lot worse than what they're telling us.
What's your gut tell you? How bad is it going to get?
Oh, hey, George, nothing's going to really make a difference, you might think, until there's oil on the shores of the Potomac, up there in Washington. So I was talking to an oceanographer who was telling me about the currents and the wind in the Gulf. And he says basically the net movement is clockwise, if you're looking from above. So as this oil slick gets larger, it'll go down the coast of Florida. It'll go around the bottom. It'll catch the Gulf Stream that goes from south to north along the East Coast, and you'll start to see oil showing up in quantity on the shores of North Carolina and eventually up to, eventually all the way up to Washington, D.C. So, this might take some weeks and maybe even a couple of months, but when it goes up the Potomac, we can talk again where I can say, I told you so one more time.
Well, David, you have been telling us for years oil is the wrong thing to use. So let's talk a little bit more about the alternative, then we'll take calls with you at the half.
Well, yeah, you've got it right, George. It's definitely the wrong stuff to use because, one time we didn't know better. So we used oil, and it was fairly easy to get at, and it ran vehicles, it, heated our homes with fuel oil. And so it seemed kind of practical, and it was cheap, but it never was the right stuff. It's really dirty. And for instance, the people all along the Gulf right now who are saying, oh, we can already smell the stuff, even before the oil reaches the beach, what they're smelling are horrible carcinogens. We're talking benzene and xylene and toluene. These are actually waste products of, that we often see as waste products from current refining. So, if you go to fill up your car with gasoline, up to 40% of that, if it's premium, can be BTX, or these super carcinogens that they can't get rid of any other way than to sell them to us so that we pay for the privilege of disposing them. So it's really the wrong stuff. So the right stuff, well, what would make a good fuel? Well, how about something, one that doesn't run out? That would be probably a good feature for a good fuel because, if it doesn't run out, then you don't have shortages or, ways of cranking the price up because it won't become more scarce. So that would be a good feature. How about something that is not toxic? In other words, if you drank it, it wouldn't kill you, That would be a good thing. What about if when we burned it, it didn't make much in the way of pollution or virtually any? Then our guilt over, possibly running SUVs and chainsaws and all that kind of thing wouldn't be such an issue. And so suddenly it makes sense to use clean fuel, where right now we're thinking, hey, you know, we better watch what we're using because we're polluting our air and we might be changing the weather. So those are all good characteristics. Well, you know, the funny thing is we already know how to make that fuel. That fuel is called alcohol, plain old moonshine. And well, George, you know, we know how to do this. You know, we've been doing it for a really long time. The Romans made alcohol to start with. And, you know, the Roman soldiers got part of their ration, you know, part of, in fact, ration, of course, is their salary, you know, and salary, of course, comes from the root word salt. You know, they got salt as part of their weekly pay, but they also got cattail alcohol. In other words, the marsh plants that we all have seen by the side of the road or in wet places, you know, that have a stalk and what looks like a hot dog on top. Well, that plant is full of starch, just like corn is, and we can ferment it and make it into whiskey. And of course, soldiers need whiskey, as we've all observed. So, you know, basically, we've been making alcohol since even back then, and we're really good at it. And alcohol fuel is something that we already are selling at 2,000 stations across the number, across the nation right now at the pump. So not most people don't even know that.
No, not at all. You know, with alcohol as a possible answer, EPA, though, does not seem to be pushing alcohol for fuel. How come?
Well, you know, it's a mixed bag. It, you know, I have a quote in my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, from back in the 40s, where this one researcher is lamenting. He says, you know, when you look at the studies from countries that have a lot of oil, they say alcohol is bad. And if you look at studies from countries that don't have a lot of oil, they say alcohol is good. And he was perplexed about why that should affect the outcome of science, you know. Well, you know, money is corrupting. And so the science, you know, from places that have a lot of oil don't look well on alcohol. And for a long time, the people in, you know, in the regulatory framework have basically frowned on alcohol, even though for us citizens, it's probably been the best thing ever because, you know, we can make it. I mean, George, you could, you know, go out there and make alcohol yourself and sell it to your neighbors if that's what you wanted to do, especially if oil was short. But the EPA actually has some good things to say about alcohol, you know, in terms of pollution. They recognize that it's 98% pollution-free compared to gas when you use it just by itself. So that's a good thing. But, you know, when you get politics involved, for instance, right now, several states want to have more than 10% alcohol in the gas.
Which is a good thing, right?
It's a good thing. The more alcohol in the gas, the lower the pollution. And, you know, last time we were on, you and I were on with Daryl Hannah, who's a buddy of ours. And,
right.
And, you know, she's got that great car from the old Kill Bill movies, you know, that 79 Pontiac, the Trans Am, you know,
yeah.
Really nice black car, you know. So, you know, that's the kind of car that the EPA says they're worried about, that older cars somehow might put out more pollution if they have alcohol in the gas than a modern car. So, what we're doing with her car showing, and we did this together at a press conference in Sacramento about a month and a half ago, that her car, a 1979 with 15% alcohol in it instead of 10, actually got much cleaner statistics for nitrous oxide, for hydrocarbons, for carbon monoxide, you know, the things that they're testing for, than 10%. So we said, EPA, what's your problem? Why are you delaying this decision and studying this again when we've known for decades that alcohol is cleaner than gasoline, up to 98% cleaner than gasoline?
David, stay with us. We're going to take phone calls with you when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Joshua P. Warren joins us with his paranormal moment. But when we come back, we'll take phone calls now with David Bloom as we talk about alternative energy. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with David Bloom. We're going to take your phone calls also right here on Coast to Coast AM. David, give us a couple of your websites, by the way, for people to write down and keep.
Absolutely. You can find out more information about alcohol fuel at alcoholcanbeagas. That's alcoholcanbeagas.com. And we have a ton of information about alcohol there. We've got lots of video clips nowadays from different kind of sneak appearances we've shown up at all over the place. And, of course, lots of action you can take about how to make alcohol reality in your community and maybe even on your own farm or business.
Is there going to be a curtailing of any more production in the Gulf of Mexico on these oil rigs?
Well, you know, when you talk about companies like Broken Pipeline, you know, what's their solution to this well? Oh, we have to drill another well to relieve the pressure. Man, when you've got 20,000 PSI, how are you going to relieve the pressure in this thing by putting another well in? It's a way of salvaging their investment in this first one. It's going to be hard to stop these guys because, you know, the perception by the government is that we're looking at, a big scarcity coming up, and no one wants to have a gasoline shortage on their watch. So whether that's true or not, that's the way everybody is acting. I mean, I know you and I have some different perspectives on, you know, how much oil is left, but whether or not there's a bunch left, you know, it's kind of suspicious that these guys have to go into more dangerous and deeper water to get it. And, you know, when the money's there, they're going to go there. Now, the thing that they really want to get to, though, which I'm more afraid of than these wells, and you think, how can it get worse? You know, we've talked about this before, George. Oil shale, you know, tar sands, turning coal into gasoline. These things are incredibly filthy, and they're expensive. You're looking at $150, $200 a barrel. That's where the oil companies want us to go, but it's too big a step. You know, we're not gonna sit still for $150 barrel oil ongoing because we'll rebel. So, you know, in between, they'll go for this expensive and difficult to get oil because they might be able to bring that in at about $125 or $110 a barrel, which we might put up with for a while. So there's a stepwise progression from, where we're at today with oil to these more expensive and really horrible solutions. And alcohol is the hugest threat to them. So if we don't want any more wells in the Gulf, we need to start producing our own $50 barrel alcohol. And who wants to buy $125 barrel Gulf oil if we're making alcohol at a decent price?
Good point. Let's go to the phones now. First time caller, we've got Arnold in Toronto in Canada. Hey, Arnold, go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to bring up a couple issues concerning alcohol.
Sure.
The first thing is when you do add it to gasoline, it does reduce fuel economy. So when if you increase the amount of alcohol, then, of course, your fuel economy will decline in your vehicle. So I'm not sure if that's a major concern. The other concern is if you're converting biomass into alcohol from agricultural land, of course, that's using land that'd be valuable for food crops. If you're taking biomass off of land and converting to alcohol, you're also taking the carbon out of the soil. So if you're going to take, let's say, corn stalks and convert it to alcohol, then you don't have anything to put back in the soil, and then you lose the fertility in the soil. So how are you going to address these particular issues?
Well, yeah, those are really good questions. And my quick response to you to start with is, they're drilling a deep well off of the east coast of Canada. You know, that's not quite as deep as this one, but almost as deep. So you might be looking at our problem really soon. So when it comes to mileage, alcohol actually is 105 octane. You know, gasoline, when it comes out of the refinery, is only 64 octane until they they alter some of the oil products to bring the octane up to acceptable.
Yeah.
Sorry, George, didn't catch it.
They juice it up.
They juice it up. Now, when it comes to mileage, alcohol up to about 30% to 40% typically gets the same mileage as gasoline because alcohol has oxygen in its chemical structure, and you get more efficiency, meaning more of the fuel turns into work and less of it turns into exhaust and waste heat. Alcohol burns almost 300 degrees cooler than gas, yet has more explosive power, that 105 octane. So although we start off with less heating value in the fuel, if we burn the fuel and just measured the heat off of it, we start off with less, and that's that figure you were quoting. That's not the same as miles per gallon. Now, if you go to 100% alcohol and you just use one of the kits we have on our site, that basically hooks up to your computer and tells the car, oh, I'm really running on gasoline, but I'm running on alcohol, that kind of simple conversion, you'll typically lose 10 or 12% miles per gallon. So that's, you know, that is something that's measurable. But if you're making your alcohol for less than a dollar a gallon, who cares if it costs you an extra 10%? So the cost per mile is definitely lower with alcohol. For instance, on Labor Day, you know, when last time I was on with George, Daryl Hannah and I were there, and we filled up her car in L.A., you know, and it was $3.23 a gallon. But in Minnesota, the same day, the price for alcohol at the pump was $1.71. And, you know, if you look at the prices today for alcohol at the pump, it's far cheaper than gasoline. So we're talking about something that when you get down to, you know, I mean, we're all smart enough to do a little bit of math and say, you know, cheaper fuel, even if we get less mileage, is still better per mile for us. Now,
so it's really a waste of money to pay for premium gasoline then.
Well, you know, yes, you are getting premium. And if you have a car that needs premium, like many do today, you're saving a lot of money because you can, if you don't make any modifications to your car, you don't get a kit from us, you just want to run on it, you go ahead and put half a tank of alcohol in and half a tank of regular gas, not premium. So now you've got up around 103, 102 right in there, octane, and at 50-50, you're now running your premium devouring vehicle on something that's even better, and it's going to like it a lot, and it's much cleaner as well, and it saves you a pile of money because they really get you for the premium. Now, you brought up food versus fuel, and I don't think there's a day in my life in the last 3 years that I don't have to talk about this with someone, because the oil companies have spent billions of dollars to try to go ahead and make food versus fuel an issue. And I got to tell you, in the last 4 years, while this issue has been in the press every day, we have had a surplus of corn. We have had up to 2 billion bushels of extra corn every year that the alcohol plants didn't buy, the food guys didn't buy, and it just sits there outside the silos waiting for someone to buy it. We all know if you have a surplus of something, the price is supposed to go down. And it hasn't, because the market is not a free market. The cost of fuel is regulated by the futures market, and you cannot find out who buys the futures contracts. So yeah, we're talking about market manipulation of the prices, and what that has to do with the food supply is that alcohol, when you produce it, only takes out the starch. We use corn for animal feed, and all the protein and fat are still there, and they actually gain more weight when you feed them the dried distiller's grains, leftovers, than they do on the original corn. Cows just can't digest starch at all. It goes out in the manure. So you can lie by telling the truth. 25% of the corn has been diverted into alcohol plants, but you've neglected to bring out just not only the alcohol leaves the plant, but also the animal feed. So we haven't lost anything. We're just using what otherwise has been wasted. And it's one of those campaigns where if you spend enough money telling people this is the way it is, and it's not true, a lot of people will believe it. So don't feel bad. You were just, you know, deluged by propaganda. In reality, we are producing so much extra dried distiller's grains, the Chinese are buying it. And this is, you know, the subject of a big subject here, where they take our dried distiller's grains and they're plowing it into their soil as fertilizer because we have so much extra dried distiller's grains. So, you know, and of course they were actually taking it wet because it wasn't even dry because they needed the water because they had such a drought there. So, you know, this whole food versus fuel thing has been an enormous smokescreen because alcohol fuel can destroy the control of oil companies over our fuel supply. And they've already done it in Brazil. Alcohol now has replaced 95% of the gasoline in Brazil. And Brazil imports no oil whatsoever. So we can do that here.
David, how much does it cost for someone to do a little home unit for themselves?
Well, you know, in our book, we show you how to build your own still because, you know, people are handy, you know, and you get out there, you do need to know how to weld.
And this is for fuel, folks, not for drinking.
Right. What we say is, you know, drink the best and drive the rest, you know. So, so the point is the fuel you make from your still is pretty nasty stuff in terms of flavor. So I would avoid drinking it. But a still you have at home that might make 100 gallons in a batch would probably cost you a couple of thousand to build if you go by the all the directions we have in our book on how to do that, which is, of course, alcohol can be a gas. Now, you might be thinking, it's too much hassle. You know, I'm not going to do that. But, you know, George and I broke the story last year where the oil companies deprived Georgia, North Carolina, and Tennessee of gasoline, where people had to wait in line, you know, miles long. And then the police had to escort tankers into the gas stations and supervise people buying the fuel. And if you think, you know, oh, no, that couldn't happen in America, we had people calling from all over the South telling us, oh, man, I nearly got in a fist fight, or I'm a gas station, you know, jockey. And, oh, man, I had to guard the pumps when we were, you know, trying to get the fuel in. So it's coming here, you know. So I guess one of the things I want to say to you is that, you know, it's not just about price and it's not about mileage. It's whether you can get fuel at all when the oil corporations decide to put the squeeze on us.
Good job. Okay, let's go next to Al in Sacramento. You're up with us. Hi, Al.
How you doing, George? I got a question for you. It's not really about alcohol, but you were talking about capping that well.
Yes.
And from what I understand, they're using sort of a box, a rectangular structure.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, a sphere
would be better.
A half dome is considerably more stable and stronger, both external pressure or internal pressure.
Absolutely.
If they were to take an ROV with a extra big coil of cable hooked to one of its claws and have maybe a little bit of high-band radar on it so they could see through the muck,
mm-hmm.
position that near the wellhead, and then drop a big sphere, or I mean a cone over the top of it to seal it inside, and if necessary, drop another one on top just to equalize pressure. In a few minutes, the pressure should be equalized in there. So now you don't have the fight of having a little ROV drop a plug onto a gusher because the pressure is equalized, so you're working in a solid fuel, fluid environment.
Well, you know, all that's not necessary if we just don't drill into high-pressure strata. I mean, the chance of accidents is enormous, as we've seen today. The very first high-pressure well they've drilled in the Gulf, they've blown it. Now, we can be as clever as we want about how we fix the problem, but let's not cause the problem in the first place. You know, I'll just tell you a quick story because we have other callers. But, you know, the DOE dropped several casks of nuclear waste in the Antarctic Ocean where they said there was no current whatsoever. And it was twice as heavy as this thing they're going to put over the well. And they came back 5 years later, and there was a 60-knot current in the same area, and they couldn't find these 250-ton casks anywhere. They were just rolled away by the ocean. So if you think that, you know, you can stand up to the ocean in all conditions, well, you're welcome to it, but I don't think we're all that powerful.
Yeah, I agree with you on that as far as, you know, not drilling in that environment, but I'm just saying as a temporary fix to solve our problem today, you know, to where they could get the stupid thing capped instead of sitting on it for 7 years with leakage all over the world.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, here's what I would do. And this is partly George's fault, okay? So George bugged me for a couple of years about, you know, well, yeah, but not everybody wants to weld. And so we started a company a few months ago that we're in the startup phase of. And we are now going to be building alcohol plants that produce anywhere from about 30,000 to 120,000 gallons a year of fuel, so people can go into the small business of supplying their neighbors with fuel. And 120,000 gallons, that's supplying a couple hundred people with fuel. So this is kind of a revolution from the bottom, where we're not going to buy the oil anymore. You know, thank you anyway. We don't want to pay, you know, into whatever they're going to charge the oil companies from now on to clean up this mess. We're going to make it in our own communities. And the company's Bloom Distillation. And I got to tell you a quick story because there's other callers. The other day when we were in the middle of this fundraising phase that we're in, the capitalization phase, one of the people who came to our talk in Ithaca, this was in Nashville, came up to us and said, you know, I want to get into your company. And they sold their Exxon stock to get into Bloom Distillation. And boy, that was a proud day for me.
Good for you. All right, let's go next to Joe in Winter Park, Florida. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
I'm a Florida boy, and I got to say, I'm worried about the problem as it stands now. So I'm wondering, could we not freeze the pipe? Because I know that oil doesn't move well in cold.
Actually, it's worse than that because it's so cold down there. They actually are going to have to heat the oil in the pipe that's coming out of this cap thing, and they're going to have to pump an alcohol down there, which is made from natural gas, methanol, to keep the oil fluid enough so they don't get what they call ice plugs in the line running up to the ship. This is nuts, drilling this stuff down there. And the day-to-day operation, you know, is just fraught with peril. If you get an ice plug, what's going to happen to the pipe if you pressurize it and depressurize it over and over again trying to clear these plugs? Somewhere in there, you're going to blow the side of the pipe out. So, I mean, we've all seen what happens when we freeze our pipes up in the Northwest or the Northeast. And so, you know, at 5 miles below the surface, you don't want to freeze your pipes.
Okay. It was a thought. Love your show, George. David, you have a great product.
Well, thanks so much.
Let's take the next minute or so that we have left, David, to talk about alcohol can be a gas. Because when you were on with me the first time, several years ago, you knocked this place off the charts. And
well,
people are interested in this.
Gosh, it's your listeners that knocked the place off the charts. You burned our server down, and you even shut down the phone company in my town, Santa Cruz, with all your calls because people wanted to get off of oil and start making their own fuel, which is what this book is all about. And other than you, George, there's not a lot of other people in the press that you know, have the bravery to get out there and say, you know, there is something we can use instead of oil. So my hats are off to, you know, your listeners, because they're the ones who are showing up at the workshops. They're the ones who, for instance, in Wisconsin and Ithaca are building stills and starting to put together groups to use waste products. And anyway, my hats are off to the listeners. And by the way, I'd love to hear your names for Broken Pipeline or Bad Plumbing, you know, that company out there in the Gulf. So send them to our website at alcoholcanbeagas.com. And, you know, the winner of the best name for, you know, for burned porpoises will be, we'll send them a conversion kit for their vehicle to run on alcohol.
All right. Very good. David, thank you for your input on this. Appreciate it. David,
sure. Appreciate it, George.
All right, my friend. You take care. Now, up next in just a moment at Coast to Coast AM, Joshua P. Warren will be joining us with his paranormal moment, training us to learn more about ghosts. That's next. We'll be right back.